Accession number 1675, Reel 1.
Colonel Strangeways, Reel 1. Could you give me a rough outline of your military career before you got involved in the business of deception?
Yes, but perhaps I better go back before I joined my regiment, which gives the background, perhaps, of what I was able to do later on. I was born into a university family. My father died when I was about 10, I suppose. There were 7 of us children, 2 girls, 5 boys, and we all went to Cambridge. The 5 boys went to Trinity Hall, and because my grandfather had been master and vice chancellor. And whatever we did, we could do what we liked, but we had to go to university first. I was determined to go into the army, but I went to Cambridge very, very gladly indeed. I didn't do much work at all. I played rugger, I rode, did all the things that a fairly idle undergraduate does. Naturally, because I was going to the army, I was in the university OTC and became one of their officers. There were 2 of us. In those days, this was, I went down from Cambridge in 1933. You applied for a regiment, but you were given a list of all the regiments with a price tag attached to each. In other words, how much money you had to have before you could go into them.
To be able to afford the cost of living.
In other words, to keep up with the regimental standards. A cavalry regiment was the most expensive normally because you had to keep a horse, you had to, etc., etc. So they got people with money. We had no money in my family, thank God. And so I had to look for a cheap regiment. Now, odd enough, in those days there was no disgrace or anything or whatever it was, just there were facts of life which you accepted. And one of the regiments which appeared to suit me was the Duke's. They had a reputation for rugger. They still have. And they required £5 a month. Now that sounds a ridiculous figure today, but it wasn't then. So I had to have a guaranteed income of £5 a month. And my dear mother, who was a widow by then, guaranteed £5 a month, which was a lot of money for her, for my first year and a half. Because after that I got automatically promoted to lieutenant. Because I came in from university. But in our way of life in Cambridge, we entertained a great deal. And every Sunday, never less than 25 to 30 dinner, lunch and day, of all sorts and kinds of people. And we all argued like blazers. And you were meant to argue. You were meant to, and whoever you were, you may be that high. If you felt something was wrong, you said so. And that's what you were meant to do. And there might be this, that, and the other of all nationalities at our table. Before I got to the regiment, I'd been with my brother officer to the Black Watch for a camp where I met names go. I forget his name, but he was a young officer then, and he was put in with his batman to look after me. I'd never been to a mess before, or anything, I'd never been near the army before. And we had a splendid time. Bernard, I don't know.
Ferguson?
That's right, Bernard Ferguson. He was a splendid person. And eventually, in I think September 33, because we stopped, university closed down and all was in June, I joined the Dukes.
What subject had you read at Cambridge?
History, in an idle way. I didn't do much work.
Can you say what it was that first made you want to be a soldier? Where did you get the inclination?
I just had. It was not a popular idea. In fact, to go into the army was in the society in which we lived was very unpopular. But I wanted to, and my dear mother was a person who was very understanding. And she said, right, get your degree first, then you may go into the army. So I did.
Was there any background or tradition of military service in the family?
Well, in history-wise, yes.
But not recent?
Not recent. Through the OTC, Cambridge, I got to know quite a number of military types. And I was interested in military history. In fact, the only thing I took really an interest of. And a man who was a lecturer to us on the military side was a most remarkable fellow, and I shame to say I've forgotten his name. He gave a course of lectures on the sort of pattern of war. And he finished off his course by proclaiming when the war was going to start, where it would go, everything. And he was so... He based on the past. Like any proper historian, he took the past and put it in the present. And there it will be the answer, which he taught me that. And he was absolutely incredible, and it did exactly what he said it was going to do. And in 1933, people were not really thinking about war. Unemployment and things like that were thought about, but war not. But this fellow, I wish I could remember his name, he had it absolutely buttoned, and he so convinced me that his way of doing things, of looking at things, his logic, was something I never ever forgot, never have got. So by the time I got to the Dukes, I had this background which, quite frankly, my brother officers hadn't got at all. They'd been to Sandhurst. Most of them were from army families.
How did they receive you as an intellectual coming in from the university?
With interest, I think, is the answer. only one member of the regiment was a little bit upset by my getting there, because I went over him in seniority, you see, which was totally unjust in one way, but not unjust in other ways. We became very great friends, and unfortunately he just died the other day. But I was older than the newly joined subalterns. I suppose in some ways I became not a leader, but a little... I wouldn't be able to help them because everyone had been through what they were going through then. But we were a very, very happy gang. Well, you were in those days. And it was great fun. We were stationed in Aldershot, Mandora Barracks. And from then we went on to Malta, which we were at, I think we were in Malta for 3 years. And in Malta, my, in quotes, military experience really began. I had a wonderful commanding officer, a man called Willie O'Zan. And we had an unusual guest night. And the commanding officer dined in. He invited a man called Doyle Hughes, who was in charge of the submarines in Malta. And the colonel was at the end of the table. And I could see him pointing to me. And I rather wondered why he was pointing at me. But I soon discovered, because when dinner was over and the port was going round, I was summoned to go and sit up beside him. And he told Doyle Hughes, "This is the fellow I'll give you." And I said, "So what are you giving him for?" There he said he wants you to do some experiments with him. Well, I went down to Doyle Hughes in Valletta, and he explained to me that he wanted 50 soldiers and myself to be prepared to go in submarines and to do experimental attacks from the sea onto shore.
Would these have been raiding operations?
Yes. And I finished up with two submarines, Thames and Severn, which are the big ones. And we had strapped onto the top of the submarine what I call tin tubs. And they had big bungs in them. And the idea was the submarine just surfaced. You got out of the conning tower, you put the bungs in, screwed them up, called your troops in, put off the things, and you paddled ashore.
How many troops? How many soldiers?
I finished with 100. I had 100 soldiers exactly. 50 were my own regiment, 50 were Marines. But I was the boss man. Once we were ashore, I was king. Once we were in the boats, the skippers of the submarines were in charge. It's all beautifully done. And we started doing this, and in the end, Malta had a great big, in those days, exercise. And Thames and Severn, with its curious people aboard, went out. We went out and across daylight, way out to sea, and we went down. And we came in together and we knocked out every single thing target we was. Nobody knew how we got there, why we got there. It was a glorious success. And we went back and we got on in our backs into our boat again. We went out to sea underneath, of course, and then we serviced and came in the morning. And that started me in combined operations. I had a cousin in Malta who was number one to Dickie Mountbatten in his destroyer. Wishart, I think his name was. And he invited me to go out to sea with him. I met Dickie. And they were doing shooting at targets, you know, a thing going across the sky, towed by an airplane.
Drone targets.
That's right. And I was on the bridge, and they had dear old-fashioned Lewis guns, which were ghastly things, and they were making a cocky holobuzz of it. And I said to Dickie, I said, look, they don't know what they're doing. He said, do you know? I said, well, I'm Command Westminster officer, so I ought to know. And he said, all yours, down you go. So I shot down, took over the nautics.
What were they doing wrong?
Oh, they didn't know. A Lewis gun was a wonderful weapon when it was firing, but it would stop.
37 different stoppages.
And you had to know exactly what to do to get it going again. And you've got to be trained to do it. So I took over this job, and I used to go out and wish it a lot. And that gave me another angle into service training. And when we got back to England, one of the subalterns had joined the Air Force, and he invited me to come flying with him, which I did. And that got me in with the air side. Now, all these things were part of my background when I needed them. They were where the world goes round. I mean, I just did what I was told. I did a lot with the Navy, destroyers and battleships, all of which came to my aid later on.
Were these attachments or experiences with the Navy and the Air Force a result of informal arrangements?
Well, everything was on the old boy net in those days. We didn't have any courses. I mean, the army was different. And I think it was a very good difference. If you wanted to do things, the opportunity was there always. Some played polo. I didn't. I was asked to. I've got a mounted from by Dickie Mountbatten. If I had done, I didn't want to. I had my own charger, was Command Weapon Training Officer. Automatically got a charger in those days, which I used to ride every morning over my ranges. And that was quite enough. I'm very fond of riding. I did a lot of it, even the end of the war, where with Peter de Havilland, we had a pack of hounds out in Germany, and we hunted. We rode every morning in the early hours. All these things come if you sort of, what you wanted to do, you did. I think a lot of the trouble was, some officers, they didn't want to do anything sort of led anywhere. But I was lucky. So by the time the war came, I had a lot of sort of background which I was going to make use of. I didn't know this later on.
And you'd served in England and in Malta.
We served in Malta. We came back from Malta. We were stationed in Borden, from which we went to war. I was then in command of the carrier platoon. I don't have such things these days, but we had these carriers, and that was my little job. After we'd landed, we went up to the Maginot Line. We were the first people to go into the Maginot Line, or the Intercontact, and there I got a sort of taste of what things were like.
Did you get involved in the patrolling program forward of the Maginot Line?
Patrolling program? I never thought of it being a program. We patrolled, of course. you see, I'm sure people made some lovely things if somebody's got a patrol. There was no program.
In some brigades there was a very formal timetable.
Well, we'd...
patrolling.
All I know is we had attached to us some members of the Grass Brigade under instruction. In other words, spreading the experience. They weren't under instruction from any other point of view except the experience. Were very good.
When you were going on patrol, did you ever actually encounter the enemy?
No, never. Well, I didn't want to count the enemy. I wanted to know if there was anybody there. But as I was still commanding the carrier platoon, my little beasts were not meant for night work, really. But we could tell, and we knew, whether when we were clear. And when the battle started, I'd shifted my job by then. I was adjutant.
A bit more about these patrols. What scale were they? Were they reconnaissance patrols or were they larger?
No. Simply you were given a line to hold and you had to obviously know what was going on within a reasonable distance. And that we did.
So how many men would go out on a patrol normally?
Oh... I would think six, looking back.
That's quite a large number for a security patrol or a reconnaissance patrol.
Well, it all depends. It was a very odd situation. You see, the civilians were still ploughing their fields and doing their jobs. I mean, this is not sort of normal...
This is phony war.
It was a phony war. It ceased to be a phony war when it started, but see, the Germans weren't bothered at that stage. We weren't particularly bothered either.
Did you find that the soldiers were getting a bit bored because there was nothing much happening?
No. That was up to the officers.
You were able to keep them busy?
Yes, well, they were kept busy. And you see, I knew the names of every single fellow in the battalion. And I knew them. I'd been on the square with the youngsters, the RSM would salute you very smartly and say, "Would you please fall in, sir?" And you would fall in and go through the drills with. And I'd done this in Walshot on the big parade grounds, and you knew one another. You learned what they were like, and they learned what you were like. You can't fool these youngsters. They know if you're on the right lines, and they'll look after you. And that's the thing I learned very quickly in the regiment, that your NCOs would look after you completely. You have whispered suggestions if you're on parade, and this, what you did, it was one, they helped you, you helped them as best you could. The regiment was a very close-knit thing, and men, the sons of men joined, you got a fellow's son joining as a youngster. It was a very family regiment, though I had nothing whatever to do with Yorkshire, but oddly enough, I didn't have a background of Yorkshire, curiously. No, we were not bored. During that period of the phony war side, I used to go around every night with my batman and used to carry goodies on our backs and take from things. I don't know what it's to describe, but it was all right. But it paid off when we started going backwards, of course.
Where were you when the balloon went up on the 10th of May?
10th of May being what? When the actual attack started, is it?
When the German attack started.
Where was I then? I can't remember. I remember coming back.
But presumably you weren't...
I was adjutant then.
But you weren't still on the Maginot Line, the battalion.
No, the battalion come back from that.
Right, yes.
We were at a place called Bashy, I think. We were on the railway line just inside the border from Belgium. I think at a place called Bashy. The signal for the outbreak was under the code word David. And I had a particularly cheerful, delightful member of the order room staff who came in and said, "David, son." And I sort of shot up. I was in bed. I shot up. Then his sort of dare called me David, you see. And he laughed. And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You know, son. David." "Oh, I don't know." And it was. And then it was all go from then on. See, we had our band and drums with us, and we had everything. We used to beat retreat every week, entertain the locals.
Where did you move to when you moved forward on the?
We moved up onto the.
Onto the dial line.
Yes. We took up position there. Not for long. We had a usual retreat.
Did you find that the soldiers were incredulous when they got the orders to retreat from the dial line?
No.
They weren't?
No. It was quite obvious what was going on. I mean, the German air supremacy was total.
But the Germans had probed the dial line, hadn't they, without making very much progress in getting across it. They'd attempted to infiltrate into it and hadn't had much success.
Well, they didn't probe it in our area. I mean, they did come up. We had minor skirmishes, but they didn't do any harm there. We were very lucky. The Dukes had been lucky for a long, long time. But by then I was the adjutant, so I wasn't in the, with the forward companies then, obviously.
Were you at the battalion commander?